Okay, welcome to this first teleclass of 2013. And first of all, thank you to Paul and Weber Training for hosting these teleclasses that are invaluable to practitioners in the field of infection prevention and control. I am Julie Storr. I work for the World Health Organization's Patient Safety Program, and I'm delighted to introduce a colleague and friend who I've had the pleasure of working with during my time at the World Health Organization. Now, many of you will be familiar with the remarkable work that Margaret Murphy has undertaken as a patient advocate and as the external lead for Patients for Patient Safety, a program, a very strong program within WHO's Patient Safety Department. And so, without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Margaret, who will talk to us about the patient experience as a catalyst for change. So thank you and welcome, Margaret.
And thank you very much, Julie, for that nice introduction. And I also want to say to the people who have joined us a very big thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak about what I consider to be the heart of the matter, a particular perspective on healthcare, that of the patient. And I send you greetings from Cork in Ireland. It is evening time here, and I welcome you irrespective of the time zone you're listening in from. And in thanking you, I want to assure you that during this talk, we will focus on the raison d'etre of healthcare, the man in the bed. And that will give us an opportunity to reflect on everyday practice as well as on management and leadership styles. It has been said that managers help people to see themselves as they are, while leaders help people see themselves better than they are. So I would ask you to go to slide 2, please. During our time together, I would like to offer an opportunity for us to consider a particular patient experience, to identify some learning points from that experience, to revisit our thinking on patient safety and the value of patient engagement and involvement, to examine our own perceptions in relation to professionalism, integrity, behaviours, particularly as these are demonstrated through transparency and open disclosure in our management of adverse events, and also to consider the quality of communications and interactions following adverse events. It is interesting to consider patient expectations and how patients view healthcare professionals. A recent survey conducted by the Irish Medical Council, of which I'm a member, has revealed that 88% of Irish respondents trust their doctors to tell the truth. I was not at all surprised by that figure, because after all, these are the professionals who hold our lives in their hands and whom we patients want to hold in high regard. Trust is paramount in the doctor-patient relationship, and in the light of those findings, it is all the more unacceptable whenever that high level of trust is betrayed. The reality is that we present for diagnosis and treatment when at our most vulnerable and least assertive. Our expectation of safe healthcare is a legitimate one, and our hope is that all healthcare professionals would, in their everyday work, do the right thing and give us the best care possible, the same quality of care they would extend to a cherished family member. It is also important that the patient be viewed as a resource, since the patient is the single entity which is present throughout the full continuum of care. A variety of professionals dip in and out of the care pathway, but the patient is the one constant. The patient is a wonderful repository of useful information and has a valuable perspective to offer because we see things through a different lens. We often see things which busy healthcare workers may miss. And crucially, the patient is also the individual with the greatest vested interest in the outcome. Consequently, our confidence in the system and in individuals is best achieved when we see adherence to existing guidelines, processes, protocols in relation to, for example, infection control through observance of the Clean Care is Safer Care guidance and the use of the surgical safety checklists. We should not have to ask questions such as, have you washed your hands? Difficult for the patient and humiliating for the professional. And because translation of research to practice can often take as long as 14 to 17 years, we do ask that the knowledge we do have in the here and now be acted upon in the here and now, while at the same time pushing the boundaries towards safer and improved care. This need not involve huge financial investment, but perhaps some reflective learning, which helps identify areas for improvement in our own sphere of work. Next slide. So where do I, Margaret Murphy, fit into all of this? Well, as you've heard, I am the external lead of the Patients for Patient Safety program, WHO Patient Safety, which advocates for a culture of safe care that is more inclusive of patient and family. It's important to emphasize that we are not career advocates. We are volunteers who are committed to being collaborative partners and co-producers of safe care. A welcome development since the birth of PFPS is that it is now generally accepted that in all our patient safety endeavors, partnership must be a key theme. Patients, health professionals, policymakers, and healthcare leaders should be working together. There is no conflict in relation to the goal as perceived by professionals and by patients. We are united in the desire for safe care. Next slide. A continuing dilemma for healthcare arises in the area of translating aspiration into implementation and action. In 2004, at the behest of its 142 member nations, WHO bit that particular bullet with the launch of the World Alliance for Patient Safety. The perception of patients and families as an untapped resource, and also viewing the patient experience as a learning tool, was officially acknowledged by the global medical community. From the beginning, the role of real patients and their family caregivers was deemed to be the core component of that alliance, and consequently it has as one of its six original action areas patient and consumer involvement, namely Patients for Patient Safety. We now have over 200 patient safety champions and 51 countries are represented. Next slide. The program accepts that taking account of the perspective of patients and their families in planning and delivering care is crucial to articulating the reality and identifying the gaps between the patient safety measures possible and the levels of safety being experienced by patients. It is necessary to ensure services are driven by patient need and are authentically patient-centered. It is a useful validation tool in relation to the implementation of guidelines, processes, and protocols, and it ensures that the patient voice is heard in the global arena of healthcare. Next slide. The core values of Patients for Patient Safety can be summarized in that we operate as a collective with a common aim of healthcare improvement. We advocate for openness and honesty for all interactions between patients, healthcare systems, and individuals. Our goal is collaborative partnership, resulting in meaningful engagement and empowerment with a deliverable of safer outcomes. And we view this as life-enhancing for all, patient, family, and clinician. Next slide. Patients for Patient Safety has undoubtedly changed the lives of real people. I'm certainly a very different woman to the one I would now be had I not encountered and embraced PFPS. At an individual level, it is a very real fact that champions' credibility has been strengthened in our own countries by being members and associated with WHO. Recognized as resource persons, we are invited to present the patient perspective in a variety of fora. We serve on patient safety commissions, task forces, committees addressing different aspects of patient safety. We speak at conferences, act as advisors to patient safety projects, We partner with healthcare providers at all levels, but most importantly, we speak to the medical student body, the future of medicine. We connect with our own country offices of WHO, we establish our own patient safety organisations, and we write in local or national publications and journals on the topic of patients for patient safety and patient safety itself. Next slide. It is also true that the motivation which drives many patient champions to partner with healthcare stems from a negative experience. Very often, these experiences can become catalysts for change in an improved health service. I particularly emphasize that we offer these experiences not with the intention of making people feel bad. We want the experience used to raise awareness about the issues, the shortcomings, the contributory factors to a tragic event, and most importantly, in an effort to promote honest and open disclosure, which in turn will facilitate the learning that can drive improvement. I cannot emphasize sufficiently strongly that disclosure is not about blame. It is not about apportioning blame. It is not about accepting blame. It is about integrity and being truly professional. Sometimes this can be difficult to achieve. I have heard Jim Conway, Senior Vice President of IHI, describe the push-pull dynamic of the engagement process as making the status quo uncomfortable while making the future attractive. I really like that phrase. He says the attractive future involves organizing the healthcare system around the patient and family, truly patient-centered care, optimizing the patient experience, and that has been found to correlate with other outcomes, including staff satisfaction, patient activation and self-management, and above all, accepting that it is the right thing to do. Next slide. That attractive future is certainly encapsulated in the London Declaration, an output of the first Patient for Patient Safety workshop held in 2005, and which states, "We patients for patient safety will be the voice for all people, but especially those who are now unheard. Together as partners, we will collaborate in devising and promoting programs for patient safety and patient empowerment, developing and driving a constructive dialogue with all partners concerned with patient safety, establishing systems for reporting and dealing with healthcare harm on a worldwide basis, defining best practices in dealing with such harm, harm of all kinds, and promoting those practices throughout the world. For example, by supporting the IHI white paper titled Respectful Management of Serious Clinical Events. What's your crisis management plan? Next slide, framework and process. That engagement imperative is also contained in the report Safety First 2006, which states that around the world, healthcare organizations that are most successful in improving patient safety are those that encourage close cooperation with patients and their families. The Irish Commission on Patient Safety and Quality Assurance describes the Commission's vision for a patient safety framework as knowledgeable patients receiving safe and effective care from skilled professionals in appropriate environments and with assessed outcomes. Michael Leonard, physician leader for patient safety at Kaiser Permanente in the United States, offers a very simple definition of a culture of safety. No one is ever hesitant to speak up regarding the well-being of a patient, and everyone has a high degree of confidence that their concern will be heard respectfully and acted upon. Despite such high-level resolve, we also know that the patient experience is often dismissed as anecdote, and consequently improvement measures are deprived of a rich source of real data, that real life experience. the first step in that engagement process is commitment, a commitment from leadership, a commitment which says that we are drawing a line in the sand. From henceforth, certain things must happen. We will proactively engage patients in their own care. We will capture in every way possible the lessons to be learned from the care experiences of our raison d'etre, the patient. And over and above that, we will embed patient and family into every aspect of our organization's activities. Next slide. You might ask, why would healthcare professionals listen to lay people? Why would highly trained individuals value the views, the stories of lay people, patients and families? In reply, I offer you the Indian proverb, tell me a fact and I'll learn, tell me a truth and I'll believe, tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever. The most effective tool we patients have to bring about change is to relate our experiences, tell our stories. Why? Because our stories evoke feelings. In 1967, Vera Keane, a midwife, wrote in the bulletin of Nurse Midwifery, facts do not change feelings, and feelings are what influence behaviours. The accuracy, the clarity with which we absorb information has little effect on us. It is how we feel about the information that determines whether we will use it or not. Some time ago, I spoke at a conference in London, and following that presentation, a Welsh doctor told me, I'm taking a lot home, while pointing first to his head and then to his heart. Vera knew what she was talking about. And how does this play out in real life? Like many others, I have undertaken advocacy work because of a negative experience of healthcare, the needless death through medical error of our 21-year-old son, Kevin. So with that in mind, let us take a look at some of the features of Kevin's patient journey and the family journey following his death. It will then be left to us to reflect on how learning from such events can be incorporated into improvement measures. Two aspects of Kevin's care have influenced my resolve to be a collaborative partner in the change process, which might make healthcare safer for future patients. One was that every point of contact within the Irish healthcare system failed Kevin, and secondly, that injury was compounded by the very real fact that learning opportunities were frustrated by damage limitation efforts after his death. And I would contend that the duty of care to the patient doesn't end with the death of that patient. Next slide. I offer you the ultimate official data in relation to Kevin, his death certificate. It lists multi-organ failure, hypercalcemia, parathyroid tumour. It is most unusual for a patient to die from primary hyperparathyroidism, especially when almost 2 years before his death, blood test results revealed elevated calcium levels at 3.51 in a normal range of 2.05 to 2.75, subsequently rising to 5.73 and finally reaching 6.1 at point of death, levels described as inconsistent with life. Next slide. When adjudicating on the quality of Kevin's care, medical experts later said the combination of bone pain, hypercalcemia and renal failure in a young patient points either to a diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism or metastatic malignancy, and these ominous results should have been investigated as a matter of urgency. And another said all the evidence indicates that the patient was suffering from a solitary parathyroid adenoma at the time. Removal would have been curative with a normal life expectancy. Research tells us that the procedure to remove what was discovered at autopsy to have been a benign tumour adjacent to one of his parathyroid glands has a 96% success rate with a 1% complication rate. Our family experience also bears this out. because 3 months after his death, his dad successfully underwent the surgery. There were wonderful odds in Kevin's favor, but we now know that every point of contact failed him. It was left to us, his family, to retrace his medical history. The story slowly and painfully unfolded. The failings and shortcomings were many in number. They were serious in nature. They were indicative of system breakdown, compounded by misdiagnosis, inappropriate treatment and management, together with issues of communication and data handling. Laboratory test results were seriously mishandled. Tests that provided sufficient data, which was ignored, and which, if interpreted correctly and acted upon promptly, would have saved his life. In fact, the potential to achieve proper diagnosis and treatment was sabotaged by a combination of filtering of results and inaction, and those errors ranged from his treatment at primary care level right through to that afforded him in a tertiary training hospital. Yes, every point of contact failed him. Next slide. As we reflect on his patient journey, we could identify many shortcomings and contributory factors. There was the inability to recognize the seriousness of his condition. Appropriate interventions were not taken. There was selective and incomplete transmission of information, non-receiving of vital information. There was the absence of an integrated pathway. The link between his uncharacteristic behavior and test results was not made. His developing neurological problems were ignored, and there was no evidence of tracking of his deteriorating condition. And of course, there was absence of direct communication with the patient. Next slide. There was his treatment at a registrar, at resident level. We call them registrars. There was the team dynamic. There was the impact of a weekend admission. And in fact, the patient was asked to accommodate the system. Please stay alive until Monday. And Kevin could just not do that. And we talk about patient-centered care. And as I said, our expectations of a tertiary training hospital were not met. Next slide. And after the event, what constitutes an appropriate response? I repeat, disclosure is not about blame, not accepting or apportioning that blame. It is about integrity and being truly professional. It is about learning and about preventing recurrence. The reality is we cannot change the past much as we would like to, but the past can certainly inform the present, which we can then use to influence the future. And isn't it so much better if we do that together, in partnership? All of this can be summarized as a process of empowerment of patients and families by enablers within the system. Next slide. So what was our experience? Yes, there were initial honest and humane reactions from individuals, for which I will always be grateful. In particular, the nurse who sat at the bedside with me in ICU. Kevin had just died. She was crying as freely as I was. She was rubbing my arm, and I was puzzled, and I put the question, but don't you see this every day? And she said, no, not that. That should never have happened. She nailed it. She didn't offer excuses, and I will always be grateful to her for her raw honesty. But in a very short space of time, that was replaced by a process of damage limitation. By and large, we were faced with defensiveness, closing ranks, lame excuses, muddying the waters, while we were craving an honest and honourable encounter with the system and with individuals, together with answers to our very simple question, how can a young man be admitted to hospital on Thursday and be dead on Sunday? What went wrong? Next slide. For example, at a significant point in his care, crucial blood test results were telephoned to the general practitioner's surgery and written on this post-it note by the practice nurse. But when writing the letter of referral to the hospital, the GP only included those elements of the blood test results which supported his own diagnosis, omitting the critical calcium reading. He filtered the results. Also, when compiling his file in the hospital, that note which did travel with the referral letter, was stuck to the back of the letter because the hospital personnel did not want it to be lost. As a consequence, it was not seen until 6 weeks after Kevin's death. You know the expression, a life hanging on a thread. At that point in time, you could say Kevin's life was hanging on something as simple as a post-it note. At a meeting in the hospital where Kevin died, the head of department suggested that even if that post-it had been seen by his consultant colleague, it would not have meant anything to him. When questioned, he said it was because it was not written as they would write it. And I then asked, are you saying because it's not written in scientific notation, it would not mean anything to somebody like you? And the man actually said yes. A proposition that CAL might not mean calcium, SOD might not mean sodium, POT might not mean potassium, and they all in each other's company. It was at that point that I lost faith, as I identified a reluctance to be honest, open, compassionate. By nature, we are not a litigious family, but you can appreciate how our confidence in any hope of ascertaining the truth through honest dialogue was shattered, and that is why we undertook litigation. Next slide. Almost 5 years later, the judge of the High Court declared, it is very clear to me that Kevin Murphy should not have died. Two GPs, a private consultant, a hospital consultant, and a hospital, all admitted liability, expressed their regret at Kevin's death, and sympathized with us as a family. Sadly, that was done not in person, but by legal representatives, so the quality of ownership is somewhat in doubt. Monetary compensation was never an issue for us as a family. The truth is, the sum of money doesn't exist, which would equate to my Kevin. And neither could we imagine circumstances in which we would derive benefit or pleasure from that money. Could you see me doing home improvements with that? Could you see me going on holiday? Consequently, we donated the settlement figure to two charities. I am convinced that proper disclosure and dialogue with us as a family would have been far more beneficial to all parties. It was also a very great pity that the energies of the healthcare system were focused on defending a lawsuit rather than on identifying necessary change and implementing improvement measures. Insensitive responses to families actually create new patients. The trauma arising from how we are received following adverse events can often be much more damaging than the event itself. So perhaps one of the things we have to do is examine why do essentially decent and professional people often behave in an inhumane way following adverse events. Next slide. It is a very real fact that healthcare staffs also bear the burden of error, and I'd like to comment on that too. Yes, as patients we cannot give permission for error, but we do understand that the practice of medicine is complex and that it's a risk-laden endeavour. I accept unreservedly that no one intended any harm to Kevin. And I recall a chance meeting with the young senior house officer 6 weeks after Kevin's death. He and Kevin had become quite friendly in the few hours he was caring for Kevin. They went to the same school, so they had a certain rapport. And he said, how are you doing, Mr. and Mrs. Murphy? Kevin was very unlucky. And I was angry, because that was all he brought away from the tragedy. But I wasn't angry with him. I saw it as a waste of an opportunity for learning and self-growth for that young man. The organization took the easy way out and left him with a very superficial perception of what had happened. And I was angry because we liked him and had a nice memory of him. Because on the afternoon of Kevin's death, his friends started to arrive at the hospital. They were confused, bewildered, in a state of shock, sitting on the hospital corridor floor with their backs against the wall, their heads and hands trying to come to terms with this. That young S.H.O. passed by. And what did he do? He stopped. He took off his white coat, the barrier. He rolled it up, placed it on the ground next to them, and he sat with them. A most wonderful, spontaneous demonstration of solidarity. He showed himself to be a decent, empathetic, and insightful young man. He deserved better than a superficial explanation, because you couldn't teach somebody to do that. It came from the innate goodness within that young professional. And nobody was nurturing that. And that's why it was met. He was also getting a level of comfort in the company of Kevin's friends, because he too was grieving, and perhaps he was being encouraged to get back up on the horse. But there are some horses where you need a leg up. I also accept that it's a burden for more senior health professionals when tragedy occurs. And to this day, I'm concerned for the resident, who also clearly found the outcome so difficult. At a chance encounter, I just identified myself as Kevin's mother. His face changed, became ashen. He looked shocked and blurted the words, "I didn't think he'd die." And he backed out of the lift and fled the scene. Clearly, no one had taken care of him either. We had just come from the man who spoke the nonsense about the post-it note. And I remember turning to my husband and saying, "They've abandoned us, but they've abandoned him too." Where did he go? Did he have supports? They didn't seem to be very evident at that time. And it is obvious that the current adversarial system doesn't serve anybody well. So here you have one example of how a personal experience can make one acutely aware of the shortcomings in relation to patient safety, and also in relation to the management of adverse events, and in relation to minding the human beings involved. So what have I learned from this? Well, if I were to compile a wish list, and please go to the next slide, it would say, observe existing guidelines, best practice and safe operation procedures, and be prepared to challenge each other. Following adverse outcomes, undertake root cause analysis, system failure analysis. Communicate effectively within the medical community and with patients. Keep impeccable records and refer constantly to them. And act out of them. Listen to and respect patients and families. Know your personal limitations. Acknowledge error and allow learning to occur. Next slide. Replicate what is good, and be always vigilant for opportunities to improve. Learn, disseminate the rare learning. Practice dialogue and collaboration, meaningful engagement with patients and families and advocates. Create a coalition of healthcare professionals and patients, perhaps on the Patients for Patient Safety model. Be honest and open, and seize the opportunity to give some meaning to tragedy. And above all, do not be seduced by what Sir Liam Donaldson calls the 5 most dangerous words: "It could not happen here." Sure it can. Anything can happen to anyone, anywhere, anytime. Next slide. You have heard me describe Kevin's journey, a huge motivating factor for change. But it is also true that motivation without opportunity doesn't bear much fruit. And that is why my first meeting with Sir Liam Donaldson, chair of the World Alliance for Patient Safety, had such significance for me. I particularly remember how he walked into the room in Whitehall, extended his hand and said, "Hello, Margaret, I'm Liam Donaldson. Sit down, talk to me." That was the first time in 5 years that anyone had said that to me. Talk to me. And what did he do? As I described Kevin's patient journey and our experience in the aftermath, he listened, and he really heard, and there's a difference. He acknowledged the tragedy, didn't offer excuses, and then enumerated on his fingertips the number of missed opportunities to save Kevin's life. He concluded by saying, "And you know, Margaret, any one of them would have been enough," as he likened Kevin's journey to a manifestation of Jim Reason's Swiss cheese model. And I returned home to Ireland a considerably healed woman, conscious of acknowledgement, of being heard, and of the potential to be part of the change process that could prevent recurrence. And what magic had he worked? He validated the patient and family experience. He was the enabler, and this was empowerment in action. WHO had identified Kevin's case as a learning tool. The possibility to derive meaning from tragedy soon became a reality and explains why and how I am speaking to you today. How could anyone in my position and with the insights gained from Kevin's case say no to such an incredible opportunity afforded by such an invitation issued in a true spirit of generosity? And isn't invitation such a powerful instrument in the engagement, empowerment, and collaboration strategy? It changes and enhances the whole dynamic of the patient healthcare professional interaction. That is the challenge we must present to healthcare organizations and to individual practitioners, to issue the invitations, to become true enablers, to empower patient and family. Next slide. My personal experience of collaboration and partnership does span the international, national, and local arenas and covers areas of policy, education, regulation, research. And I would be the first to acknowledge it would never come about were it not for the vision of those in healthcare who believe in patient involvement and engagement. These are the true leaders and innovators. They invite participation and offer opportunities for engagement. Was it not Helen Keller said, there is one thing worse than being blind, and that is having sight but no vision? I have been a participant in many meetings and gatherings across the healthcare spectrum, and as with all advocates, my unchanging expectation is that I be treated with respect, listened to, and that my concerns be taken seriously. I have not once been disappointed in that expectation. Yes, some of my views have been challenged and debated. Others have been accepted and embraced. And isn't that how things are supposed to work in the adult world when adults engage in partnership? So I'm well pleased with that and continue to avail of opportunities to voice the patient perspective in a partnership setting. Next slide. Yes, the story may be considered as anecdote, but it has its impact. We need to produce a body of research which will provide the evidence base for that level of impact. I was particularly moved when a young woman working in risk management and patient complaints said to me, I heard you speak some time ago, and I just want you to know that I'm now doing work, my work differently. And when asked to explain, she said that when she opens a file, a patient complaint file, she now says to herself, how would Kevin Murphy want me to deal with this? I think that's pretty neat. Similarly, following presenting at a regulatory affairs professionals conference in Lisbon, an English doctor told me that Kevin's story reminded her of why she entered medicine in the first place. She paused and then said, there must be something I can do. And when I go home, I'm going to find out what that is. So here we have this young man, this young deceased man, helping this experienced doctor reconnect with the idealism of her early years in medicine. And when you combine that with her maturity and level of experience, you certainly have a powerful mix for assuring patient safety. My interactions with students have reinforced my very strong conviction that as part of their education, they must be exposed to and develop for themselves an appreciation of the value of the patient experience. I find that basic statements such as you ignore at your peril the concerns of a mother and simple measures save lives resonate with the student's eagerness to go beyond acquiring knowledge and mastering skills to appreciating both the patient perspective and the importance of preserving the relationship of trust between clinician and patient. These core values are essential to care that is compassionate, quality assured, and above all, safe. These same values need to be revisited and reinforced at intervals, almost like a vaccination program. When students accompany me on my son's patient journey, engage intimately with the shortcomings in his care, and identify the patient's safety issues, many of them pledge to do better, and in the process they also identify with a real person whose patient experience serves to underpin the lessons of the didactic course material. The value of the patient's story to professional education is also acknowledged by the teaching faculty, as articulated by one academic. Once again, I'm trying to make medicine a safer place for patients and junior doctors, and I believe that you play a key role in that. You know how much I appreciate and value your input into our intern program. I think that Kevin's story will once again have the most impact on these young professional men and women before they commence work. I also receive many messages from students similar to this email from a young man. At a very personal level, I know that I will always remember the story of your Kevin, and also your courage in bringing to the attention of myself and other junior doctors embarking on our careers in medicine. I hope that you're able to continue your excellent work in the future, and wish to thank you for sharing the story of Kevin's life. And another, I was very moved by everything you said, and I'll never forget it. I will always speak up, and I will always be honest. Could I, Kevin's mother, ask anything more of someone embarking on a career in healthcare? To always speak up and to always be honest. Next slide. Yes, formally embedding the patient perspective into healthcare education is key to patient safety, sustainable culture change, and healthcare improvement. Research conducted at the University of British Columbia highlights that students remember what they learn from patients. The authentic and autonomous patient voice does promote the learning of patient-centered care. Next slide. We are asking that the healthcare system and the individual practitioners within that system conduct the business of healthcare in a culture of openness, transparency, and true professionalism. In so doing, they prove themselves worthy of the trust placed in them by vulnerable patients and concerned carers. Going forward, for us, leadership is key, a style of leadership that will ensure that what it is asking of frontline staffs is possible, that the culture, the systems, the supports are in place, and that they are sufficiently robust to enable the delivery of safe care. The patient safety issues highlighted by current patient experience can be summarized as relating to, next slide. No, sir, pardon me, my error. Communication, doctor to patient, and vice versa. In this context, communication refers to more than information. Communication, doctor to doctor and to other healthcare professionals. Necessary safeguards to ensure that communications are received, interpreted correctly, and acted upon promptly. Communication and interpretation of laboratory test results and the implications for diagnostic error. Viewing the patient holistically and valuing the intimate knowledge the family has of that patient. The role of family advocacy on behalf of the patient. Resisting the temptation to over-rely on past experience. Yes, experience can serve one well, but it also has the potential to result in tunnel vision, as happened in Kevin's case. The desirability of having the patient fully informed and viewed as a partner in his own care. Identifying danger times in the journey, for example, transitions from one care setting to another. The dynamics of the care team. What do you do when you're the boss? How do you facilitate junior members to voice their concerns? And what do you do as a junior member in order to be heard? Identifying dysfunctional teams and protecting the patient. Professionalism and integrity following adverse events, necessary supports for patient and family, and necessary supports for clinicians and healthcare professionals following those same events. Next slide. In 2008, Lucien Leap said, "The time is now. If health and our healthcare are at the table, then the consumer, the public, the patient, the family member must be at the table, every table, now." That calls on healthcare to embrace patient engagement and involvement, and it calls on advocates to have the courage to challenge. And I like to think of us as being somewhat like the piece of grit in the oyster, causing sufficient irritation to bring about that precious pearl. And in this case, the pearl is that of healthcare improvement. Getting back to Jim Conway's maxim about making the status quo uncomfortable while making the future attractive. Next slide. In shaping the way forward for advocacy conducted according to the Patients for Patient Safety model, we acknowledge the lessons learned. We acknowledge that it is the right thing to do, that it works, that it benefits healthcare at all levels, individual and corporate, that it benefits the PFPS membership. Healthcare does want to partner, but does not always know how to bring that about. PFPS can help remove the barriers and be a facilitator by being the conduit between the reality, the experience of the man in the bed, and high-level policy and decision-making. The WHO linkage and support is critical to maintaining the unique status and potential of PFPS. So the challenge, as always, is to translate aspiration into reality. It is incumbent on us to do that, because at a very simple level, the cost of not doing that is far too high. Next slide. It goes without saying that the attractive future is certainly encapsulated in the Patient for Patient Safety London Declaration, which is our grounding statement and intrinsic identity. It says, in honour of those who've died, those who've been left disabled, our loved ones today, we will strive for excellence so that all people receiving healthcare are as safe as possible, as soon as possible. This is our pledge of partnership, our patient pledge of partnership, and it is my continuing pledge of partnership. Next slide. It is significant that quite recently, the internationally respected surgeon Atul Gawande wrote in the New Yorker that more than anything, what distinguishes the great from the mediocre is not that they fail less, it is that they rescue more. At many points during his patient journey, Kevin sorely needed someone to rescue him. And my sincere wish is that as we go forward, whatever your role in healthcare, all providers will resolve to operate out of that all-important rescue mode. It is, however, equally true that patient and family have a vital role to play in that rescue exercise, as do patient advocates in the broader scope of healthcare provision. So it is up to healthcare to issue the invitation, and it is up to us to accept the challenge to be critical friends in a meaningful collaboration. And finally, I want to say I was present at Kevin's birth. I know every detail of that birth. I was also present when he died, and as his mother, I needed and deserved to know everything relating to how that came about. And over and above that, it is essential that I be assured that lessons will be learned, that those lessons will be disseminated, all in the hope of preventing recurrence. Because as Sir Liam Donaldson says, to err is human, to cover up is unforgivable, but to fail to learn is inexcusable. Thank you for accompanying me on this journey.
Margaret, thank you very much for, once again, a powerful and inspirational presentation. And I'm certain that Patients for Patient Safety will continue to grow and to have an impact on healthcare, and, you know, looking forward to working in partnership with you on that. I know that some people will have questions, and if any of you do want to contact Margaret or ask any questions related to this presentation, then Margaret's address is on that final slide, slide number 31. So I'd like to thank you all for listening to this teleclass. Thank you once again, Margaret, and this is the end of the teleclass.
God bless everybody.